One of the most important things for me about this collection, Black Nature, is its statement of our presence and our stake in observing and enjoying the landscapes and flora and fauna that are our birthrights as well.
That was eco-poet, essayist, and two-time NEA Literature Fellow, Camille T. Dungy. And this is Artworks, the weekly podcast from the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. There's been a romanticism to nature poetry since the ancients. Enamored poets observing untouched bucolic settings, existing comfortably outside of the nature that they're observing. Well, eco-poetry strips away this illusion. Outside of nature does not exist. We are part of that natural world. Eco-poetry highlights the complexities within the environment, its impact by and on the societies and cultures within it, and the multitude of interconnections between humans and the environment. Award-winning writer Camille Dungy is one of the most important voices in eco-poetry working today. In a genre long dominated by white voices, she explores these entangled connections between humans and nature from her position as an African-American woman in the United States. And she does it with precise detail, rhythmic lyricism, and a broad inclusiveness. Her fourth collection of poetry, Trophic Cascade, for example, gives us poems where nature, motherhood, loss, and racial violence all intersect. And while the collection never shies away from confronting the wounds of environmental degradation and the violence of racial oppression, Dungy is also aware of the hope that our deep interconnectedness to the natural world and to each other makes possible. Camille has a score of writing honors, including a 2019 Guggenheim Fellowship, and she's received not one, but two NEA Literature Fellowships, one in 2003 for poetry and another in 2018 for prose. Camille T. Dungy is also the editor of the 2009 pathbreaking anthology, Black Nature, 400 Years of African-American Nature Writing. The anthology challenged assumption about nature writing by insisting that the place of African-American nature poets be recognized on their own terms, as writers whose connection to nature is often complicated by history. In other words, existing outside of history is as impossible as existing outside of nature. Given that insight and the range of poems within its covers, Black Nature remains a book as significant and as far-reaching today as it was when it was first published.
It's a thing that makes me quite happy, actually, that 11 years later, this book continues to be so relevant and useful and practical, because when I was pulling it together, the idea that Black Americans would think about the natural world in poetry was sort of a surprise. And when I did the research I needed to convince the press to take on the project, I reviewed all the major anthologies that were available at the time in 2006. And all of those major anthologies actually only included six poems by five Black poets. It was like we just weren't there in the canon at all, which was very surprising to me because in my own personal file of poems I love, I had about 45 such poems that would have fit. And so I had to really think about why this just really gross erasure had happened of Black poetry and correct that absence.
Well, you most certainly did with this anthology. And you open the book with Lucille Clifton. Do you mind reading that?
I would love to read that. Lucille Clifton is one of my heroes, and I'm so happy to have so many of her poems included in this anthology. Surely I am able to write poems celebrating grass and how the blue in the sky can flow green or red, and the waters lean against the Chesapeake shore like a familiar. poems about nature and landscape, surely. But whenever I begin, the trees wave their knotted branches, and why is there under that poem always an other poem?
That is Lucille Clifton, and that is the way you began this book. Tell me why.
It does seem like the perfect example of part of why those erasures existed. The fact that so frequently when African-American people are writing about the greater than human world, there are these moments where you just bump into the realities of history, the realities of violence and danger and terror, economic realities and political realities and cultural realities that are tangled up in the landscape and inescapable in that way. And when you have an idea of environmental poetry or nature poetry dealing only with pristine landscapes, landscapes where people don't exist, to borrow language from the Wilderness Act, landscapes that are untrammeled by man, you then expect the poems out of that space to not have these complications of history. But so many really, really wonderful poems that think about our engagement with the environment do also think about us, right? Do think about people and how we treat each other. And those poems need to be seen as well.
Well, you have 180 poems from 93 poets, and the poems span 400 years. Can you tell me your thinking in the selection process?
This was such a fun process, the collection of this anthology. And I feel like it's really important to point out that the work was there. I was not creating work out of whole cloth that didn't exist already. The work was already there. It simply wasn't being seen in this category. So I was living in the Bay Area at the time. So I used Stanford's library and Berkeley's library. I went to the Poets House in New York. Emory University has a wonderful Black poetry collection. And I spent some time there making sure to just really read into the African-American literary canon and find these overlooked pieces. And I also reached out to living writers and invited work from them. And their responses became really interesting to me, that one set of writers would say, thank you, I have been doing this work my whole career and nobody has seen it. Thank you for seeing it. Those writers included people like Ed Roberson, who we now really do understand as one of the preeminent voices in American eco-poetry, Yusuf Komunyakaa, Lucille Clifton, right? These are poets who could have their own collections of their environmental poetry alone, and they weren't included in the literature. And the other response from writers was that they were surprised that I was asking for work from them because they didn't see themselves as environmental writers. One of my favorite stories of this is the poet Sean Hill, who we now do very much consider a member of this world. But Sean Hill said, you know, this is a poem about my first job. And it, you know, it was like to him, again, it was like an economic poem, or it was like a poem about memory. The poem was called Seven Pastorals at 16. He was a shepherd at 16 years old. If the man who is the shepherd cannot write a pastoral, which is the ultimate in the world of the nature poem, who does get to write the nature poem? But there was not a space where he had been able to see himself in that way yet. That was really exciting to be able to be part of that opening.
Well, there is a lot of weight in these poems. We're getting the view from the fields rather than from the manor house.
Yes.
And history is ever, ever present. Because how do you exist outside of history any more than how can you exist outside of nature?
Correct.
And one poem that I think really illustrates this so beautifully is Margaret Walker's poem, Sorrow Home.
Mm. Yes. Oh.
Would you mind reading that?
I would love to read that poem. Oh, goodness. Thank you for bringing me back to this poem. Margaret Walker, Sorrow Home. My roots are deep in Southern life, deeper than John Brown or Nat Turner or Robert Lee. I was sired and weaned in a tropical world. The palm tree and banana leaf, mango and coconut, breadfruit and rubber trees know me. Warm skies and gulf blue streams are in my blood. I belong with the smell of fresh pine, with the trail of coon and the spring growth of wild onion. I am no hothouse bulb to be reared in steam-heated flats with the music of L and Subway in my ears, walled in by steel and wood and brick far from the sky. I want the cotton fields, tobacco, and the cane. I want to walk along with sacks of seed to drop in fallow ground. Restless music is in my heart, and I am eager to be gone. Oh, Southland, sorrow home, melody beating in my bone and blood. How long will the clan of hate, the hounds, and the chain gangs keep me from my own?
That is Sorrow Home by Margaret Walker. Tell us a little bit about Margaret Walker.
Oh, Margaret Walker. She was a novelist and a poet. She won the Yale Younger Poets Award for her first collection, For My People, in 1942, and was the first Black writer to win that award and continued to publish prolifically through her lifetime and received many, many honors and awards for her work, including the novel Jubilee. So her writing was very, very often rooted in history, but also in the struggle to claim space and an ability to thrive and survive in a place that is your own.
Yeah, place is just so central to Sorrow Home, even the title. And you can just feel that desire and that urge to return to a home in a space where you're not safe.
Yeah, that you love.
That you love.
And you should be allowed to love, but that joy and peace is being consistently robbed.
You know, the breadth of styles in this book is just extraordinary. And you chose to not present the work chronologically, but rather thematically, just in a general sense. I don't expect you to go through the whole thing because, you know, it's a very substantial book. But generally, how did you think about organizing these? Because when I'm reading it, I'm seeing writers in conversation with one another.
Absolutely. That's one of the things that I love to do when I am editing is to create those conversations through time and space and aesthetic and culture and area of interest. So the book is organized into 10 cycles, and you are introduced to each cycle with an essay, a short essay. When I commission the essays, I ask the people to think of them as vestibules, this entry space into the mind of this particular section. And we begin with cycle one is just looking, and it's just these poems that are very observational and not necessarily canted in one particular direction or the other. It's just that big, wide, open eye. And then the poems moved into a kind of sense of connection. Then the cycles become darker and more fraught, and they speak to the violence that is often inherent, particularly in the African-American experience in this country. There's an entire cycle that looks at our relationships with other living beings, bugs and trees. There's an entire cycle thinking about disaster, which so frequently the things we call natural disasters are really human-caused disasters, or at least a collaboration between the human and the wind or the river and the places where we are allowed to build or not allowed to build, and et cetera. And so there's a cycle that really looks at that. One of the most interesting cycles to me is one that really looks at a sense of ownership. Like, I belong here. That comes towards the end of the book. And it's this regrounding cycle. And that one is the only cycle in the collection where no poem was written before the mid-1970s. And in fact, most of the poets were born after the early 1970s, meaning that the mind of the poets who are creating those poems are forged after the major strides of the civil rights movement and the Black Power movements. They are minds of people who have been able to make a home and buy property after the Housing Rights Act and redlining is made no longer legally the path for excluding people from different properties and things. And these poems are really different from the poems of their predecessors. And I made a point throughout the collection of trying to be really equal in terms of gender representation, in terms of regional representation, and in terms of time out of which the poets are writing. But that one section, when I did that review, I noted that that time element was not equitable. And I decided to leave that as it was, because that seemed to make a really important statement.
There are poems that are unlikely, that are funny and that are charming. And one is a Richard Wright poem, number 175.
Towards the end of his life, Richard Wright wrote all of these haiku that are just, oh, they're just such a delight. And sometimes they're heartbreaking and sometimes they're funny. And this one that you're mentioning is, it feels a little of both to me, actually. Number 175, coming from the woods, a bull has a lilac sprig dangling from a horn. It's funny, you can see this image of this kind of sweet bull with this lilac sprig, but always in his haiku, I think an element of almost tragic nostalgia, right? Because I feel like you can see otherwise. You can see around the corner past that delightful image of the bull into the image that we usually see of bulls, right? And the violence and large terror, really, that comes in the body of a bull. And Richard White's pushing against that expectation for what a bull is with this sweet little lilac on the horn makes that expectation even louder to me without his having written it into the poem. I just think that's so masterful.
And it's so visual.
Yes.
And it also, there's a scent about it.
Yeah. I talk to my students about that a lot, the sort of need to try and get all your senses into a poem whenever possible. And, in a haiku, to have managed to get sound and sight and smell in that few number of syllables. That's quite impressive, right?
Yes. Yes. Well, the last cycle of your book is Comes Always Spring, which is a perfect way to end, I think, this book. I really hate just hearing parts of poems, but your poem, What to Eat and What to Drink and What to Leave for Poison, is really long. So would you mind just reading the first stanza?
I'd be happy to. What to Eat and What to Drink and What to Leave for Poison. One. Only now, in spring, can the place be named. Tulip poplar, daffodil, crab apple, dogwood, budding pink green, white green, yellow on my knowing. All winter, I was lost. Fall, I found myself here with no texture my fingers know. Then, worse, the white longing that downed us deep 3 months. No flower heat. That was winter. But now, in spring, the buds flock our trees. 10 million exquisite buds, tiny and loud, flaring their petaled wings, bellowing from ashen branches, vibrant keys, the chords of spring's triumph. Fisted heart, dogwood, grail, poplar, wine spray, crabapple. The song is drink, is color. Come, now, taste.
It's a wonderful poem, Camille, and it really fits so beautifully for the closing of this book.
It's important to me to remind readers that the Black experience in America is not all trauma. it's not all pain and suffering and horror. There is beauty here. There is belonging and peace and joy. And as the Sorrow Home poem noted, one of the most frustrating things is having the ability to access that joy be robbed from you. And one of the most important things for me about this collection, Black Nature, is its statement of our presence and our stake in observing and enjoying the landscapes and flora and fauna that are our birthrights as well.
Well, I think that's a really nice segue into your own book of poetry that I really also want to talk about because it's terrific. It's called Trophic Cascade. First of all, what is a trophic cascade?
A trophic cascade is the events that happen when a trophy creature, a top predator, is either removed from or replaced in a landscape. And so the presence of that top predator will then affect all the lives up and down the food chain and will affect really great changes on a landscape, either via their removal or their presence in a space. So that is the ecological concept of the trophic cascade. And in the collection, I speak directly to that in an ecological sense, but I'm also throughout the collection thinking about my own trophy creatures, my daughter and elders, and what changed in the landscape of my life when they either appeared or disappeared from my worlds.
Why don't we hear the title poem?
Trophic Cascade. After the reintroduction of gray wolves to Yellowstone, and as anticipated, their culling of deer, trees grew beyond the deer stunt of the mid-century. In their upreach, songbirds nested, who scattered seed for underbrush, and in that cover warrened snowshoe hare. Weasel and water shrew returned, also vole, and came soon hawk and falcon, bald eagle, kestrel, and with them hawk shadow, falcon shadow. Eagle shade and kestrel shade haunted newly buried runnels, where mule deer no longer rummaged, cautious as they were now of being surprised by wolves. Berries brought bare, while undergrowth and willows growing now right down to the river brought beavers who dam. Muskrats came to the dams and tadpoles, came to the night song of the fathers of tadpoles. With water striders, the dark gray American dipper bobbed in fresh pools of the river, and fish stayed, and the bear who fished also culled deer fawns, and to their kill scraps came vulture and coyote, long gone in the region until now, and their scattered seed. And more trees, brush, and berries grew up along the river that had run straight and so flooded, but thus dammed, compelled to meander, is less prone to overrun. Don't you tell me this is not the same as my story. All this life born from one hungry animal, this whole new landscape, the course of the river changed. I know this. I reintroduced myself to myself, this time a mother, after which nothing was ever the same.
Trophic Cascade. There is so much I love about this poem. That turn at the end, where suddenly we're moving to a vast landscape, to an equally large life-changing moment. And it really reminded me of the beginning of Dust Tracks on a Road, Zora Neale Hurston's book. Mama died when I was 9 and changed the world.
Well, that is a comparison that makes me quite happy. Thank you, because Zora Neale Hurston is one of my heroes.
Tell me the impetus for this particular poem.
There was a viral video that was going around the time when I was writing this poem, and I just was obsessed with it. And I was so obsessed with it that I went, you know, and I did further research and I found out more about what those animals would have been in the area and what they look like and where they lived, you know, and I just was writing all those things in the big list part of the poem, where I was just really interested in that ecological story. And then I just stopped one day and thought, why? Why does this matter to me so much, right? I mean, it was a level of obsession that was curious. And why did I care? And that's when the turn in the poem happened, because I just figured out that it felt like me. It felt like that Yellowstone landscape was my life. and so the poem was complete. And then it sat for a while looking like a normal poem, lined up on the left margin of the page. And I just was dissatisfied with that until one day I just went to the top of my Microsoft Word and flipped the alignment to make it a right justified poem, because of course my whole landscape had changed and I just flipped the landscape of the poem in that way. And then it was ready.
I'm curious about your interplay between research and these imaginative leaps, because you do use such precise details about nature.
My father is a scientist.
Oh, okay.
and so precision is important. You name things what they are in the home I grew up in, and I'm so grateful for that training. Among other things, the naming things what they are actually makes the world more friendly. It makes the world feel more like I am entering a room and I know everybody's name and who they are and where they're from. So the ways in which I'm able to see the greater than human world in that collaborative sense as other vibrant living beings with stories of their own that I'm interested in, that's helped me as a person as much as it's helped me as a writer.
You talked about the way a poem looks on a page and its significance for you and certainly for us as readers. The way you used the blank page in the poem Brevity is extremely powerful. It's a powerful poem as is, but the way you have that placed, man, does it really clobber the reader. Could you describe what you did and your thinking behind it?
Yes. The poem is quite brief. Brevity, as in four girls, Sunday dresses, bone, ash, bone, ash, bone, ash, bone. That's all that's on the page. And this book is a non-standard width book. And so if a normal trim size is about 4.5 inches, this one is about 6.5 inches. So it's a lot of blank space around that. And then you turn the page and there's another very blank page. And at the very bottom is a grayscaled line with these names: Addie Mae Collins, Cynthia Wesley, Carol Robertson, Denise McNair. Those were the four girls who were killed in the Birmingham church bombing. And I didn't want to just put that information in the notes in the back, like incidental information. But I also didn't want it to be like right away, you know, like footnote. And so the visual decisions around how to make that work are really part of the whole way that I constructed that poem. Their names needed to be there, but you also needed some time with the images of the poem before that part came in.
Very, very powerful. How do you begin? Do you begin with an image, an idea, a line? It depends on the poem.
It absolutely depends on the poem. In that case, all the language in that poem came to me as it is written, you know, woke me up in the middle of the night with that phrase, and I wrote it down and I thought that I would go back and expand on it. Actually, what I did was go back and pull back. At the end of the poem, I had the phrase, "the end," which I removed from the poem because sadly, there has not yet been an end to that kind of terror and violence for Black children in this country. And so that felt insincere to have the phrase "the end." So sometimes poems come to me almost completely. Sometimes, though, far more frequently, it is just long periods of time doing research, thinking. Sometimes it's about trying to find the right words. Sometimes it's about getting the details right. Sometimes it's about the shape of the poems on the page. Sometimes it's about figuring out where the poem starts. And so my belief is always you just write and your poem's intelligence will reveal itself to you if you are open to it.
You've received two NEA Lit Fellowships, one for poetry in 2003 and one for prose in 2018. And I'm just curious what these fellowships allowed you to do.
Oh my goodness, these fellowships are so important. I'm so grateful. Writing takes time to really be able to breathe and to read and to do the research, but also honestly to just take walks sometimes and just sit still with the ideas in your mind, which our very busy lives don't often allow. I tell the story sometimes with the Poetry Fellowship. I was able to take a semester off of teaching and go and do research for what became my second book of poetry. And I remember a day where I was just talking to somebody. I was at an artist colony and I was just talking to somebody about the work I was doing. And they said, "Oh, have you gone to see the map rock?" And I was like, the what? And there was a rock. It was outside of Sarasota Springs, New York. There's a rock where enslaved people who had self-emancipated, the easy term we use is runaways, right? Had etched a map onto this stone, onto this boulder, that when you looked at it carefully, knowing what you were seeing, there was the lake, there was a boat, there was a ferry dock, it was a trail. But if you didn't know what you were looking at, it just looked like strange little markings on a stone. I would not have been able to have that experience. I would not have been able to get away from my paying job. I would not have been able to afford to travel to this place to have touched a stone that had guided people to freedom. And so to me, the NEA is the stone that guides writers to freedom. The NEA is this moment in a writer's life where they can really feel seen, and that people believe in their work, but also that they have the time to be in their work. So I am ever grateful. As a prose writer, it was really the same thing. I kind of had just pivoted into writing essays, and I was a newbie in that field as well, a field in which I never had formal training in the way that I did with poetry, right? And so how presumptuous of me to think I'm going to start publishing books of essays. But that NEA really was a boost in my confidence that I must be on the right trail.
Tell me what you're working on now.
I have actually just finished and passed along to my agent a new collection of personal essays. If Guidebook to Relative Strangers, my 2017 collection, was about traveling out in the world and understanding my place as, in America as a Black woman while traveling, this new collection is really focused on home and my own backyard and what I can learn about history and my place in it from looking in my own backyard.
And can I ask you to read one more poem to end this lovely discussion?
Absolutely.
If I choose, I would love you to read Against Nostalgia.
Oh, yay. That poem started as an email. Since you're asking where poems come from, and, you know, sometimes you write a little thing that seems like it's just a little quip, and then you think, there may be something else there. I may need to go back in and see. Against Nostalgia. I suppose you have food there too, but here it is summer, and we have asparagus, avocado, and stone fruit. I am so happy. The yard trees of my youth yield more fruit than we can handle. I was going to bake chicken with cherries and apricot, but already it is too hot. I can't turn on the oven. Sometimes I bite straight into plums. Other times I slice them to serve on a platter. Sometimes I want to move away, so I must remember everything I used to love. Stone fruit and asparagus, drafts of eucalyptus carried through the window on the wind.
And that is a lovely place to end it. Camille, thank you so much.
Thank you for your questions and your attention and your care and this opportunity to speak with your audience about my poetry and the poetry of other African-American environmental writers.
That was eco-poet, essayist, and two-time NEA Literature Fellow, Camille T. Dungy. We were talking about her edited work, Black Nature, 400 Years of African-American Nature Writing, and her collection of poetry, Trophic Cascade. You've been listening to Artworks, produced by the National Endowment for the Arts. You know, April brings a multitude of blessings. First, it's spring. Then, it's also National Poetry Month. And it's also Jazz Appreciation Month. Join us as we celebrate the 2021 NEA Jazz Masters, Terry Lynn Carrington, Tootie Heath, Henry Threadgill, and Phil Schapp. The NEA, in collaboration with SF Jazz, is presenting a star-studded virtual tribute concert in their honor, with remarks from second gentleman and longtime jazz lover, Douglas Emhoff. The fun takes place on Thursday, April 22nd at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. The concert is free and available to watch online. You can find full details at arts.gov. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.